Well, hey everyone, just because we're indoors and hiding from a virus doesn't mean we can't still shop for records. AudiophileUSA.com is still online and still shipping worldwide. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated business specializing in excellent and near-mint vinyl records. Only the best of the bunch get listed at AudiophileUSA.com, many in original shrink wrap, some of them still sealed. These are generally original pressings, likely the best condition records you're going to find, and they have a heap, over 42,000 titles in stock at AudiophileUSA.com. You'll definitely find something there, and you'll get it shipped directly to your front door. Head over to AudiophileUSA.com now, poke around, and get yourself on their mailing list so you get first dibs at all their new loot. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Find your holy grail. And with that, let's start today's episode of The Vinyl Guide.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hey, that's me. Hey, everyone. It's Nate here, host of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks for downloading. Thanks for listening. Thank you in advance for sharing these episodes. I fully realize that not everyone has the means to be a patron of our show at patreon.com/vinylguide. If you can, please do. That's patreon.com/vinylguide. I put all sorts of extra stuff up there. It's just a few bucks a month. Whatever you could spare certainly helps this podcast. But let me just be clear. I know not everyone can do that, especially in the current climate today. So if you want to do something nice for your buddy Nate and you're a little bit light on the cash right now, that's okay. Just leave us a positive review on iTunes. Share these episodes on social media. Tweet them. Put them on Facebook, Instagram, wherever. Help us spread the word. That doesn't cost you a cent and helps us immensely. I'm quite excited about today's show. We have Jared Blum here on The Vinyl Guide. Now, who is Jared Blum, you may ask? Well, not only is Jared the head honcho of Gigante Sound, but Jared is also a sound designer, a musician, an experimental composer. He's part of the Talking Book Project, which features Billy Gould of Faith No More, who we had on the show last week. Now, if you haven't heard our conversation with Billy, check it out. It's episode 217 of The Vinyl Guide. And when I was arranging the interview with Billy, he mentioned to me, he said, "Man, you should really talk to my musical partner, Jared. I think you'll find him really interesting." And who am I not to take advice from Billy? So I arranged a discussion with Jared, and wow, Jared is really a fascinating guy. He's got a tremendous streak of creativity, energy. He's got lots to share about music, capturing, manipulating sound, synthesis, creation. I could go on. Jared also uses a turntable as an input into the process of creation, which is fascinating to me, as most of the time we have on the show, some people who use turntables as an output to their creativity. Quick disclaimer, I come from a history of synthesis. In the early and mid-90s, I was a sound designer for companies like Korg, Kurzweil, and Sonic, EMU Systems, and more. I used to work in various recording studios, designing sounds. I worked with people like Keith Emerson and Aerosmith. And I spent months, if not years of my life, in front of a computer, staring at digidesign products, sampling, synthesizing, manipulating sounds. And I have such a wild checkered past I don't get to share too often. But with Jared, I found a bit of a kindred spirit who followed his passion much further than I did. And through him, I got a bit of a glimpse of the cool stuff that I'd be doing had I stayed on that path. Now, before we get into today's conversation with Jared, I must share the project that Jared and Billy did, Talking Book 2, is available in very, very limited vinyl pressings, 500 units. Get yours now. Go over to coolarrow.com. That's cool with a K, coolarrow.com. Get over there before they are all gone and pick one up. That's all, Kickball. Let's get into today's conversation with conceptual artist and fellow sound nerd, Jared Blum. Another East Coast track. Thank you. This week on the Vinyl Guide, we are talking to Jared Blum of Talking Book and Giganti Records. Jared, how are you today?
I'm very good, thank you.
This new album, Talking Book, is really interesting to me. Experimental music, however, it's, as a term, seems extremely broad. How would you describe the music of Talking Book?
The first record, I would say, in a way, was a little bit more quote-unquote experimental. We definitely dealt with a lot more abstract sort of styles and more focused on textures and a little bit more with drones and stuff like that. And with this record, we kind of took that, the abstractions and the textures and the drones, and then sort of combined them in with this kind of weird, some of them at least, weirder sort of pop arrangement. Not pop, but more traditional song arrangements. And that sort of came out of playing some stuff, doing some stuff live, and not really wanting to just be this, like, quote-unquote, total sound experimental thing. I think for all three of us working together, I think it was kind of more fun for us to explore some of our, like, traditional, like, songwriting roots and throw in the experimental stuff. But really doing it in a way that felt organic.
So you mentioned you start with some of the traditional song ideas. Is it with traditional instruments? Like, for example, on the new album, there was only a couple of tracks where I could really hear, like, oh, that's a piano or that's an accordion.
Right.
The rest of it seemed to be a lot of soundscapes and more, I guess, electronic synthesizers.
Yes. This record was put together in a very unique way, at least. For, I would say, for more traditional songwriters, we came at it on a whole different way. One thing that I do a lot is collage, and I will take sounds from wherever that I have on my computer, things I've made, things that Dominic or Bill have sent me just randomly, and just kind of put them together and to form something. And so something might have started with just the piano thing, and then we layered stuff on top of it. And so there are definitely traditional instruments on this record, and there's also traditional instruments mutilated and manipulated and layered to not sound like, really, you can't really tell what they are, but they work in their role in the song. So if it's something that's like a sharp attack, then that could be a guitar, but it can also be, I don't even know what, it could be a synth, it could be something like a zither that's been taped and put onto a cassette tape and slowed down. You know, we have a lot of that stuff. There's a lot of found sounds. There are stuff that we've recorded out in the world that just worked, you know. There's two tracks in particular that Bill actually wrote as demos, and then we layered some more abstract sounds on top of it. And then there are songs that start as complete abstractions that then get a melody or some sort of structure on top of it. That's sort of the best way to sort of put it.
So when you and Bill and Dominic get in a room, you say, okay, well, we're getting together at 2 o'clock today. You get together in the room. Yeah. How does the creative process start?
So in this case, we actually only got in the room together twice, and we basically just play. And each of us have our arsenal of instruments or sounds or samples or whatever, and we just play. And some stuff works together, and some stuff is just there. The beauty of it is that we record everything separately, so everything's multi-tracked. So later on, I was able to take those sessions and really go through them and make little parts that happen that work between the three of us or the two of us, and then and or go in and just be like, oh wow, what Dom was doing is really rad, but it doesn't fit with what any of us were doing at the time. But if you just isolate what he was doing, that can then become the basis for a track. Just his there's a couple of parts in there that are like weird rhythmic stuff that you hear on the record. A lot of that's his stuff, and so I was able to form new tracks using stuff like that, or cutting bits up from that jam and putting it through a sampler and actually playing a bass line or a melody using a sound that someone made. So there's so many ways you can manipulate sound and be really creative with stuff in a non sort of linear fashion, and that's how this record really was made. One of the ways it was made.
Yeah. But by the way, your phone line is starting to break up a little bit. It's starting to kind of
Oh, really?
Your voice is going robotic. But I'm going to just assume that you are writing a song right now.
I wish. Okay. We'll just keep talking.
That sounds all right.
We'll
try to find I'll let you know if it gets completely unrecognizable, but we'll deal with it. From what I understand, one instrument that you guys play is actually a record player as part of the instrumentalization. Yes. Can you describe the role of the record player in creating the music?
The record player, especially on the first record, is actually called the talking book record player for the blind. Basically, what it was is a record player that was able to play at, first it played at 8 RPM, then 16, then 33 and a third. And it even has a neutral button, so you can like actually spin the record at your own speed. So I used that for a project called Beats Plinth a long time ago. And I was using World Records and old World Records and Exotica Records, anything that has really good like isolation. So like just a drum or just a one sound, because if you have too many sounds, it sort of gets a little too mushy.
Yeah.
So I would start recording records and then just cutting up little bits that just sounded great. Just big hits, like a vibraphone from a Martin Denny record. Sounded like, you know, I wouldn't say a gong, but just like a boo. It's just unbelievable. And the texture from the records, and you know, the needle on the thing is not that great. You know, it's one of these little, I don't even know, it's like a little plastic needle that you can find, cartridge. And so that's how it all started. So I just started making records using that. And then Bill and I started messing around with that. And that's how the first record was made, basically. And then this record, those sounds are, you know, in on our drives, and I resampled them all the time, and I made new ones, and that's how a lot of the, I would say maybe a quarter or so of the sounds are from either records or tapes that are just been slowed down and then like cut up into little bits. So like you'll hear like a, you know, I would use a sound and just layer a snare drum with that sound, so you would just hear this. It didn't sound like just a snare drum, but it would sound like, you know, an old clank with a snare. So it just made everything a little bit mushier, a little bit more I don't know, just a little bit more original sounding to my ears. And that's how we ended up using the record player for the most part in this record.
Now, do you have to worry at all in this age of litigation and everything like that? Do you have to worry about the source of the content of that?
No, I don't think in this case. I think it's so you really have to get close to the source to know what to be close to that. You know, like this stuff is so destroyed and recycled. No, I'm not worried about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good. So when you record, how much is deliberate and how much is luck or discovery?
I would say in the beginning, about 80% of it's luck and discovery. And then you just you got to get to a point where you go, okay, this is starting to happen. And once you get it to start to happen, then you can put your thing into it, the melodies, the this and that. But like the initial thing, the vibe, the feel, that's all just discovery. And you kind of have to know what's on your drive or whatever you're going to make. You kind of have to know what those things are kind of going to sound like a little bit. But yeah, it's a lot of just chance, and that's the best part about it. That's why I love doing like collage work, because you just don't know. And the thing is, it's not something that you could pre-plan. It keeps things really loose too, which is really nice. Mm. You know, like if using Dom's bass part, I was like, I would never come up with that. I would never come up with that sound, but he did. And now it's our thing. And it's sort of a way of like, and I think it's almost, you know, like in the moment, I don't think he would have played that part. But now that he has it on my computer, now I can do it and manipulate it and pitch it down a little bit, maybe fix a note that sounds like, ooh, let's change that note to this. And boom, it's like, and it comes alive. And so it's a lot of luck and just a little bit of like tweaking. And then you're like, oh, this is good.
So preparing, it sounds like you're in a constant state of recording sounds and audio manipulation, and then just storing these up. And then once you get together, as you start a project, you start kind of going through your library of sounds. Is there a, like if you heard a sound that Dom created.
Yeah.
Could you pretty instinctively tell that, oh, that's Dom. That's something Dom would totally do. He's way into the filters. Is it?
Yeah, exactly. You nailed it on the head. He has a very particular way that he works that I don't work, and vice versa. And we work together in another project. So I've been working with him since 2005. So I know his feel, and you know, he's gotten new gear and everything, but he still has a feel just like I do. And so when we work together, yeah, I totally can tell that gross thing that you're hearing under this, that's him. You know what I mean? And that's in all due respect, like, that's the best part about it. There's a song, oh God, it's the one with the melodica. I can't remember the name of it, but there's this in the beginning of it that starts the whole song, and then the melodica and everything come in. That's his sound. All I did was pitch it up, and it's perfect. And it's just, that's the kind of stuff that you don't really think about. Oh, let's put a little something in there. You know, in fact, no, you don't think about it until you're in the studio and you're just like going through sounds. And you're like, oh, this is sweet. And you just kind of, let's just use that as our beginning. And then, I don't know. It's just weird things like that. It's just, you just got to get into it. And it's like building, it's architecture. You know, you're just building and layering and layering, and then just picking stuff apart and going, oh, okay, this is cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when do you know when you've tweaked with it enough? How do you know to stop?
That's the problem. That's half the reason this record song is that we got to a point where, like, all right, this song's good. And then I'd go back and listen to it. And then Bill would go away for a month to do some tour or whatever. And then I'd be like, it's just not right. And then he'd listen to it, like, yeah, you're right, it's not. What could, you know? And then we'd futz with the drum or whatever. We'd completely rearrange it or like pick it apart. And then we're left with just the piano part. And we go, you know what? That sounds really cool, just the piano part, you know? So it was tough to, you know, I feel like all of these songs could have been remixed in some way, and we would have been like, yeah, this is cool too. So there was really, there are times when you're like, yes, this feels right, this is good. But there's a lot of open-endedness to this kind of music. I think it can keep going and going and going.
Again, I'm very fascinated with this music, and you've spent much of your life creating it. How did you get to this point? Did you pass through all the traditional music, listening to like Beatles and Led Zeppelin, and eventually kind of say, like, you know, I'm going this other direction? How did you arrive here?
Yes. So I played bass in bands and rock bands, but always with a little bit of an experimental side. I guess I was always into stuff that was a little edgier. Starting with bands like Faith No More, when I started playing bass, it was like Faith No More and Primus and Fishbone and Jane's Addiction, that kind of thing. So already you're sort of a little left field, right? Mm-hmm. And then as you go, you keep going more left field, or you kind of veer toward the middle. I kept going more left field. And what happened was, there was a point when our band wasn't really happening. I was in college, and my buddy and I both set up our own separate studios in our bedroom at the time, and that's when I just started just doing my own stuff, and that's when I started listening to Brian Eno's stuff and Aphex Twin and, you know, the Talking Heads and King Crimson and all of Fripp's and all that stuff, right? You know, that zone there. And that took me there, but I still had like I still loved all the pop stuff. So the beauty of my music thing is that I actually have a whole pop side that I work on too. It's a little left field, but it's there. But this side, I just kept going with sounds. And I was like, well, and I always loved like the lo-fi thing. I think bands like a band like Boards of Canada were one of the first to really like bring that VHS sort of like mushiness to melodic electronic music. Them and, you know, Aphex a little bit, but mostly like Boards of Canada. And then from there, it was just like, that's where the journey began of like, oh, I can just use this old 4-track and it sounds great, you know, and I can pitch everything down, and I have this old cheap, and I never had a lot of money to buy really great gear. So it was all just like using what I had. And that sort of led me to the more experimental side. And once I started using computers and being able to kind of use samples or use and have like, you know, files that I can just pick and then manipulate on the computer. I was like, this makes sense. This to me, you know. So, right.
Would you consider yourself more a musician or an engineer?
I'm definitely not an engineer. I am not the one you want to be, you know, it's more of like, I'm definitely a musician, but it's more, and it's not sound design. It's just more like, I don't know how to explain it. It's just, I guess it's more like a architect, a sound architect in a way, like, just building stuff out of nothing or something, you know. But yeah, I would definitely be more musician than engineer because I'm not really into the whole technical stuff. My stuff's somewhat simple. It's deep in its thing, but in terms of like, I don't spend all day trying to get a great snare drum sound or you know, working on the mix and maybe that's half my downfall sometimes. I just want to make the music, you know what I mean? I just want to let's make another track. Go.
Yeah. And just speaking for myself here, I started as what I thought was a musician, but I would put my instrument down 9 times out of 10 just to fuck around with a sound. I was much more fascinated by that. And it took me a while to work out that, you know what? What I really like doing is not playing that thing. I like being in front of the computer and dicking around on Sound Designer. And that's kind of my sweet spot. So, and that's exactly. In my mind, that's how I almost describe an engineer.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yes. In that definition, for sure. That's exactly what I'd rather do is just sit in front of my computer and just like dick around and find really cool little bits and cut everything up and put them together. And that's, oh yeah, for sure. But I'm coming at it as with a very musician, traditional sort of musicianship space. I mean, some of the stuff I do is completely abstract, which is those projects. But a lot of the stuff I've done has some sort of musical form that I feel like can be a little bit more, not commercial, but a little bit like easier to sort of digest.
Well, like Blanket Ship. To me, that sounds more, I won't say traditional, but recognizable.
Oh,
I
totally. Think, to people. Absolutely.
Is Talking Book on the other end of that spectrum for the music you create, or is there a whole nother section that's like way out there?
Talking Book's somewhere in the middle of my musical zone. So I have really a couple projects that are complete left field, and then I have stuff that's complete bright side. So I have a project called Vision Key and also this project called Kagami, which are both like rooted in 80s electronic music, mm-hmm. but from a very specific era and style. And so it's also soundtracky, but it's also that prog kind of side of 80s music that I don't hear a lot of. And it's just a challenge for me to make. So a lot of Japanese-esque stuff, more or art pop stuff, like Peter Gabriel, the Genesis stuff. So anyway, so like the Talking Book sort of lives in the middle because it's a little bit of the Blanket Ship sort of stuff, but it's also a little bit of like, not quite visiony, but a little bit of that. There's melodies that you can kind of follow and build in there. So Bill kind of adds a whole other musical world that he comes from. And then you have the real left field side, which is like my project with Dom called Volcano 68 and a project I have called Flaps, which is just complete, just gross music. And so it's kind of in the middle. It's absolutely dead center in the middle of my universe.
And I would imagine there are people all around the world that are extremely interested in this sort of music. How does one connect to an audience that would appreciate this?
I don't know. And that's the thing that we've been like discussing is that it's like, it's either it's not enough screwed up or it's too screwed up. So between the music I listen to, you know, I have like my touchstones of my experimental musicians that I'd love to listen to that this music would be too commercial for. I think maybe not. I'm just thinking out loud. But then again, like for the Faith No More fans, like this might be a little far-fetched, but you have people who like Faith No More who like Mr. Bungle and some of obviously Trey's projects or Mike Patton's projects, which also can go pretty left field. So there might be a little bit of leeway there, or a little more acceptance in the Faith No More community. But I don't know. I'm not sure what the real experimental guys. I think they'd appreciate some of it. I mean, I think some of the sounds are great and some of the thing is. I mean, I just like the fact that we are sort of just in the middle. It's just sort of like give you a little bit. We're not just giving it to you. And I also think that the cool part about this project is that it doesn't sound like a lot of the big soundtrack music that's coming out these days. And that's no way like a I have an issue with, like, you know, the Trent Reznor stuff or the Hacks and Cloak stuff. I love all that stuff, but it's just a lot of the new stuff is just very, it's big and it's clean. And a lot of the sounds are just so like big and just cinematic. And we didn't want to do that, you know, wanted to kind of make it a little bit like you're listening to an old, you know, cassette thing or an old Serbian film. And this is the music from it. You know, that's sort of what we were going for. We've always been doing that, you know.
Now, Gigante Sound. Am I saying it right? Gigante?
Gigante.
Okay. All right. So Gigante Sound is your, I want to say, label? Is it, how do you describe
it? Was
Gigante?
It was a label between Dominic and I. We haven't been working on Gigante Sound for a long time. For the last probably 6 years or so, nothing's been released. It was just a way for Dom and I to just put out stuff freely. And I think both of us were like, where do we send this? Like, at the time he was working on a project called Borful Tang. I had Blanket Chip, and it was sort of like, where do we, who wants to put this shit out? So we just kind of like, and Volcano 68, we just said, let's just do it ourselves. And it was a CDR label, but it picked up some steam and we got good reviews. We played a couple shows on WFMU, but as time went on, each of us sort of started working with other labels. And so the Gigante thing sort of went away. And it's a lot of work also to keep up a label, no matter how small it is. It's a little different now with Bandcamp and everything's a little bit. But back when we were doing it, the internet wasn't where it is now. And, you know, it was mailers, it was CDRs, it was all that stuff.
So a lot of trips to the post office. Yeah, I noticed you guys did a I noticed you guys did a vinyl split. Thomas Carnacki, Volcana 68. It looks like a beautiful vinyl. What was that experience like? Was that a pain in the ass? Was it a pleasure?
No, not at all. It was a pleasure. Thomas Carnacki's amazing. If you've ever had a chance to listen to their stuff, this guy Gregory Sharp is one of the, and they're just fantastic. And it's all, and you have to kind of see them live. And I think that's the thing, is each of them, they have different configurations, but they have, each of them has their own little station, and they all work with micro sound. So like, Greg might have a setup with a little micro contact mics of, you know, just little found objects and stuff, and together, and maybe one guy's playing violin and a bicycle spoke, and then the whole thing just comes together, and it's very, you know, Nurse with Wound esque, and it's that kind of feel. And so they just did their thing, and Dominic and I just did our thing, and we were like, oh, well, I got 20 minutes, you got 20 minutes, let's put together a thing. And we also couldn't afford Dominic and I couldn't afford to just do an LP by ourselves. It's so expensive.
Yeah.
And have it be pretty looking.
Okay. Yeah. The reason I brought it up is because I noticed Gigante Sound, it had all these different releases, and that was the last one. And I thought, okay, maybe something happened that one to completely turn them off of this.
No. It was actually Carnacki's idea. And they were like, hey, let's do a split with you guys, because, you know, we can put our money together and make a cool record. And it worked out. So. Okay. And we do it again, but it's just, we're in the process of putting all of the releases of Gigante Sound on Bandcamp finally. And then also I have one more Blanket Ship record, and he has one more Borful Tang record that I think we're going to also put out in the near future. Just got to get it mastered.
So Gigante Sound is just paused for the moment.
Yeah. It's on pause, but it lives forever in the cloud, I guess.
Okay.
So you can listen to everything and buy everything. Oh, another Volcanus record too. We finished a Volcanus record that will come out, and that's actually really good because it's current. It's shit we just did.
Okay.
So it feels good. It's it yeah. Total Music Concrete style, like early 60s Concrete feel.
Now, I noticed on a lot of this, a lot of the CDRs, a lot of the artwork is very, I'm going to just call it spooky. I know that's a completely simple word, but a lot of it is just very distorted, very, I mean, it's compelling. It certainly draws the eye to it. How important is the visual connected to the audio?
Pretty important, kind of works with the vibe of the record, I think. I just want things to look like it's been an old record. That's for my personal music is like, I love what I would do actually, just find really old records and just scan just like a little bit of it. It's almost like how I sampled music, but just like a little corner of the record, you know, you can't really tell what it is, but you just get all that texture. Mm-hmm. And I love that. And that, I think that's where a lot of that comes from. And then, you know, again, collage, maybe something on top of it from another feel, or create my own little thing. But it does have a lot to do with it. But it usually came after the fact. And I was kind of like, oh, what's the vibe of this record? And then I would come and make something for it.
In Talking Book is relatively new for me. I'm probably going to, in time, consider you and Billy and Dominic, this album is a bit of a gateway for me exploring other avenues of music.
Cool.
Which I'm
great.
I think I'll be indebted to you, but let's talk in 10 years and we'll see. If,
yeah, I would love to. I would listen. No, first, I can send you some stuff that you might like that's not too over the top that mm-hmm. I think you'd be into, like that, you know, no problem. And that's the thing is like, that's, I love when people show me music, like, or like, oh, here. And that's why I mm-hmm. check out blogs and stuff all the time. And I'm like, oh, this looks cool. And I read about it. I'm like, ooh. And that's how you find out about stuff, is people tell you. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know, or show you, play you.
For the longest time, I didn't get jazz. But then I finally had a friend of mine hand me this one particular Miles Davis album, which was kind of the, like I said, the gateway, my entry point. And okay.
How are you with it now?
Oh, I love it. And one of the reasons I really love, yeah, especially some of the old jazz, the Blue Notes from the 60s and 70s.
Sure.
In my mind, again, going back to that musician/engineer, yeah. I, a lot of times I'll listen to music because I used to work in recording studios. I used to, you know, I understand the composition and kind of how you build up those layers. And a lot of times I'll hear music and my mind will not be focused on the actual music, but more like, how did they do that? How did they record it? Oh, that's a phalanger. That's this. That's, you know, oh, they must have punched in there. Right. You know, totally. So, but with those Blue Note recordings, especially the ones that Rudy Van Gelder did, those were,
of course,
one take, all mm-hmm. in the same room.
Yep.
And there's no room for that sort of dissection. Nope. So I just focus on the music.
That's amazing. Yeah. Totally. It's 100% feeling and playing. And
yes.
It's just, you know, four guys in a room in Englewood Cliffs, New Jersey, in a basement, just going. And then they probably had a gig the night before and they got a gig right after and they're just in it.
Yeah.
100% in it. And it's like, it's four dudes talking. It's amazing.
And at the absolute top of their game and without one clam note. Right. But I mean, riding that tightrope for a while, you know, after a while is, again, my brain starts looking for something else to kind of get towards. And maybe this experimental music is my new jazz. I'm open to that. But Talking Book, again, it feels to me like, okay, this is finally something that can bridge that for me.
Great.
My question to you is, what was the entry point to bridge you between, let's just say, some traditional music to starting to think more in this direction?
Geez. I mean, again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, where the Enos and the sort of minimalist movement and also like some electroacoustic music. So, you know, the Stockhausens, the Luke Ferraris and Bernard Parmigiani. Like when I first heard tape music a long time ago, I actually took a class in college called Intro to Electroacoustic Music. It was offered. Of course, I had to take it. And I think that was the first time I was like, whoa, this is how is this being done? Like, I didn't get it, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you started realizing that it was done in these. So the early stuff was done in these huge college, actually universities, both in Europe and then also in New York. And they were just using these really old oscillators and tape machines and very, very limited stuff, but it was all done on tape. It was all tape manipulation and cutting, splicing, and all that. And I immediately thought it was the coolest thing. I just loved that stuff. But I also loved like stuff that was eerie sounding. And I think the eeriness has always been in my music. Something is just a little darker, a little bit, you know, like that's always been there. And I don't know exactly where that comes from, but it's just the power of music. It's like when the Monolith is shown in 2001 and just that Penderecki choir. Oh, it's a Ligeti choir. And it's like, that was it. I was just like, that's amazing. You know, so it was, I was always kind of into something, stuff like that. And, you know, heavy metal too is always a little dissonant and dark. So, yeah. Mm. I should have just said also is that Disco Volante, that record alone might have changed my whole perception of music along, because that happened around 95. That's about the time, 96, when I was like, okay, this is what I needed, you know, like soundtrack music. That record is completely like the bridge for me. I should have started with that because that is the bridge.
Yeah, I've only in about the last 2 or 3 years said, okay, I get it now. I'm getting it. Like I couldn't appreciate Disco Volante when it first came out. I was like, what the fuck? And then it took a while. Neither. Yeah,
it took me about a year. I remember I first heard it and someone had played me because I loved the first record. The self-titled record, I loved it. I was all over it, you know, slap bass and all that shit. And then I heard this and I didn't even know it came out. Someone played it for me and they played me the first track and everybody I know from high school is dead. And I was like, oh my God, what is this? And then later that summer, because I was the next summer, I borrowed the tape from someone. I was like, you know, I'm going to listen to this. And I think I just popped it in and Violins of Domestica came on. And I was like, oh my God, what? And I just, that's it. From then on, it turned my whole musical life upside down. I was like, okay, I got soundtrack music, electroacoustic music, easy listening, thrash metal. It's all right there. Circus music, the whole thing. It was just, it just knocked me around. So that was a big one.
Yeah. I had to work a lot of things out of my head to be able to then open it up for Disco Volante. A lot of assumptions and expectations, which that's fine. So,
but I also give it up. Sorry, I don't mean to interject, but he had that Web of Mimicry website and he put up a bunch of his recommendations. I don't know if you remember this, but it's in there. I think it's probably, he put up this thing. It was like the wall of the museum of whatever mankind. I don't remember what he called it, but it was just what he thought was the best records. And he was selling them through his website. And it was Parmigiani. It was Diamestru. He had a bunch of stuff, but the Indian stuff, the Bollywood stuff, and that, the Morricone, like that was it. I was like, oh my God, I knew about this stuff, but I never like stopped to like listen to it and analyze it and go, oh my God, the playing is insane on this. So that's it. Yeah.
So how did you find yourself working with Billy then?
I knew him for a couple of years before we started this project. I met him randomly, and I was a big fan. I've always loved Faith No More, but I was a big fan of his particular bass playing. I loved his tone. I loved his style. And I just went up to him, was just talking bass with him. And then I actually told him, we're like, hey, listen, you know, my buddy and I were going to start this label and I would love it. If you have time, I would love to just, I asked you some questions about having to start an independent label and we just shot the shit went out for drinks. And then I offered my services like, look, if you ever need anyone to help Cool Arrow, I'll, you know, he didn't really have a proper office or anything, but it was like, I was like, I'll be your intern, you know, I'll help. So I helped him with a couple of releases and I wrote some stuff and we stuffed envelopes and CDs and I did what I did. And we kind of got friendly and he helped me mix some of my Blanket Chip stuff. And then the Beaks Plinth stuff, which was the first foray into the Talking Book record player and the slower stuff. We started listening to it together and he'd be like, oh, this is cool. Let's add, maybe if you add some blah, 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 delay and reverbs. And I think at the time, maybe we were both looking like for an in to start doing some soundtrack music professionally. And that's sort of how it began. He was like, yeah, I just remember him saying, yeah, I think this is really cool. Maybe we can like try to work on something together. And I was like, sure. You know, and I didn't really play guitar, but he can play guitar also. And he threw down some guitar textures over what I had done. And we just kind of sent things, or actually his studio is near my house, so we kind of worked together on it, and that's how it came about.
Do you have a vinyl collection, or you're more of a digital guy, I think, right?
Well, here's the thing. Okay, I have a vinyl collection, but I stopped really buying vinyl to listen to vinyl. I don't have it's just the money, and then also just it's the room. Like, I don't have a lot of room anymore to store vinyl. But the thing about a lot of the Blanket Chip and the early Bleak, all of that was me going down to the Goodwill or Amoeba and the dollar bins and just finding the weirdest stuff. And or not even the weirdest stuff, just stuff that I thought looked interesting, and that's what I would use. You know, I would just find whatever and just use you. All you have to do is find one little cool part of a record, and it's, you know, I loved finding the stuff that was at the Goodwill that was at the front of the door because they didn't even want to put it in the stacks. You know what I mean? Like, they were so screwed up, or they just, it didn't have it didn't even have a cover, and it was just an old organ record. I made a whole record out of that record. I still have it. It's a Buddy Cole Christmas record, something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's fucking amazing because it's just these, and you play it slowly and you get the textures and you get those long chords. It's like, that's all I need, you know? You know, when you'd walk around San Francisco back when I lived there, and it was like, dudes would just put out records on the side of the road, and you're like, all right, I don't care what it is. Easy listening, you know? So I love vinyl. I mean, I have such a thing with vinyl. I just don't do that kind of sampling anymore, and I don't listen to vinyl really. I just still have a collection of things, and people have sent me, people have sent me records, and of course I'm going to keep them and listen to them, but I just don't collect vinyl anymore. Right. I'm assuming you have a huge vinyl collection.
It's too big. I got to get rid of some shit.
Exactly.
Man. That's a lot of time to be spending on finding those sort of sounds. What do they say? You got to kiss a lot of frogs to meet a prince. I mean, was that a frustrating process for you at all?
No, because if I didn't like anything or if it was unusable, I would either just throw it away or it just didn't matter. And I did a lot of stuff with records that I would like Christian Mark Clay would do, where he would cut grooves into the record. Mm-hmm. So you can have the record would skip. He had a way to do it because he had good tools. So he actually can make loops with it. I didn't. I just dug my nail into it or whatever. And so it would just get this skipping things, and you can get these weird little rhythmic things that happen. And the thing is, even if the rhythm wasn't totally perfect, you could just throw it in the computer, and you can kind of move things around to get that thing to kind of work a little bit better. But that's what I would do. And I had a stack of records that are just scratched to shit. And I would just play them and let them just skip and then find little cool little rhythms in the recordings. And it didn't matter. And I was just throw it back on the pile uncovered. I didn't care if it got ducked. It didn't matter. So I loved using the records as my instrument, you know. And I used to play gigs with two turntables and just mix things live, and it was okay. It wasn't as good as they sound recorded, but you know what I mean? That's what I did a lot of times. I never paid more than $5 for a record.
And these are records that are completely, no one's paying attention to them, but it's.
No, they're in the dollar bin at Amoeba, and it's but it's some of the old stuff that no one, it's like the Hawaiian lap steel thing. And it's are you kidding me? That's gold, you know? And then you can get some cool little melodies from that too. And then you can use those, back in the Blanket Chip days, I would find a cool little melody that just worked. And then guess what? That's now on my record. I would have never written a melody like that with that instrument. So that's the beauty of sampling, hip hop guys would, but they didn't, I don't know. I never find hip hop that interesting. And I mean, I just don't know enough really cool hip hop where dudes were doing really kind of screwed up sampling, that.
Who are your sampling heroes?
A guy named Jeremy Novak. He had a project called Dymaxion. He put out a what label was that on? Drag City. Just look up Dymaxion. Anyone who likes what I'm talking about, listen to Dymaxion. That's one of the records that is the holy grail for me, that kind of threw me into being I'm going to use trying to figure out how he did it. And he was using sound designer too, also real basic. I know him. We're good friends, and I've seen his studio. I mean, we're talking like super basic. Who else do I like sampling wise? Shit, I'd have to go in. But yeah, like the Boards of Canada guys, you know, that whole thing. Mm-hmm. But Jeremy's stuff, Dymaxion, you'll hear what I'm talking about, because he was all about finding really obscure, just like, and he'll just use one little hit, and that would be the, you know, a sample. And it's really great.
Oh, who is that guy? John Oswald. There was.
Oh, yeah. Plunderphonic stuff's kind of cool. I was into that for a moment. John Oswald, Wobbly, People Like Us. That's who I was listening to a lot when I was doing that early stuff. Really great. But yeah, there was always a little. It's a little. I feel like some of that could teeter on novelty, a little too comedic. And I think I started doing that, and I kind of pulled away from that and just wanted to make more like just weirder songs that just were made up of samples that couldn't tell, like, you know, like I didn't want to make it so it was like the, oh, I know what this is from. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so when you start using the really weird records that you find, it was just a little bit more mysterious. And I think that's something that like Dymaxion, it was like, it's very mysterious. And I just love that thing where you're like, I can't tell if this is a live band. Is this like, what is this? Yeah,
I'm gonna check them out. So, I don't know about this. So, yeah.
I'll send you a link or whatever, please. And I think you'll really appreciate it.
Please, Jared, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us a bit of a glimpse in terms of the process of creating your music, especially Talking Book. Again, it's a whole new area for me. I'm assuming there's quite a few folks that are kind of in that same boat, but I think it's a Talking Book seems to be like a quite a good gateway drug into this whole other world. So I'm very thankful for you and Billy and Dominic for creating it. And I would definitely recommend people check it out. There is a limited vinyl pressing at coolarrow.com. That's cool with a K, coolarrow.com. Of course, you can also find out more about what Jared's doing at Gigante Sound. Is that Gigante Sound.com.
And you can check out some other stuff I've done on Root Strata Records or Root Strata. Yeah, those two labels I've worked projects with. And then, of course, Coolarrow.
Perfect. And yeah, feel free to send me some links and I'll put them on the episode page.
Absolutely.
Again, Jared, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I love your show.
There we go, ladies and gentlemen, Jared Blum of Talking Book and Gigante Sound. I'm going to put those links in this episode page. Of course, you can always type them out yourself if you have trust issues or anything, but otherwise, Gigante Sound with a G, or go to coolarrow.com. That's cool with a K, coolarrow.com, and pick up one of the limited 500 vinyl units of Talking Book 2. It's pretty amazing album. It's really interesting to just put on the headphones and fold yourself within the sound. And I think you'll like the experience. It's really cool. It's unlike anything else I have in my record collection. And I think I'm going to start off on a little bit of a tear down the road of this sort of thing. Jared has sent me links of some of the audio, some of the artists that he mentioned here on the show. Those will also be in this episode page. So check it out. Enjoy. coolarrow.com, cool with a K, arrow.com. Grab Talking Book 2 now. And that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Again, thank you so much for tuning in and listening and enjoying. And please share these episodes. Put them on social media, on Twitter. Do what you got to do. Help us get the word out. Give us a nice review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. That would be much appreciated. Or just show a fellow record nerd how to get this podcast. I know we're not having a lot of face-to-face time these days, but some of your record buddies are probably pretty lonely in their houses right now. So give them a call or do a quick Zoom meeting and show them how to use that stupid smartphone of theirs to get the Vinyl Guide podcast. And there we go. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.